I'd basically like to ask questions still from the Krishna Samhita's introduction, because I thought that that would be a very nice course book for the students. And I really like the way how Bhaktivinoda Thakur proposed the whole idea. He approached history teaching when he first said there are small-like and S-like people. And small-like people always like everything. Generalities and the general problems, and those who start interviewing questions, these are rather like S-like people.
That means questions that are aren't really important.
Yes.
Because the point is that swan-like means is that, because that's from Saragrahi. That's a term that he uses. Saragrahi means one who takes the essence. So the Saragrahi is looking for what is the essence of it, what's the purpose of it, because what's going on is it, the externals of it historically are not necessarily what's important, but it's what is the lesson that's learned, the experience, you know, the motives behind it, that's more important, you know, because otherwise the factual history, you know, could be anything, you know, it's just like, you know, person A hits person B over the head with a bamboo, so that could be just out of anger, it could be a political thing, it could be, you know, there was, you know, how you say, there was a mosquito on his head, so that, you know, it means there could be so many reasons. So then historians will interpret it that way, but the Saragrahi is looking for what's the actual, what's going on, what is to be learned from it. And history, just for history's sake, because it's old, it's not actually very important. You know, it's past, it's gone. So unless it has some value to the present and something to learn from it, why dig up old things? You know? So that would be one of the elements there, is that it's the lesson to learn from it that is important. And when you get into the detail, well, what kind of bamboo did he use? Unless that was an important element in there, that it would add to it, then it's not important. If by doing that it would be, you know, but if he had a mosquito, why did he use a bamboo? You know, because in other words, you're still trying to find out what is the result. You know, which means the goal there is to get rid of the mosquito. So then, if it's a mosquito, why he couldn't use his hand, or why he couldn't use this, or like that. And, you know, then there would be an explanation, because it's in connection with that, rather than you're distracted from the actual storyline by side details that have nothing to do with reality. You know, but if in there he says, well, actually, you know, it was a, you know, how do you call it, a bamboo rod, and because he was so far away and they'd been trying to catch that mosquito, you know, for half the day. So if it was there, then he used that and he, you know, tapped him on the head. You know, so then it comes out, but the other way it looks like it's some, you know, different. Does that make some sense? So if it has relevance to the actual purpose of the historical narration, then that's a swan-like, right? You know, that's swan-like. But if it doesn't, it distracts and actually gets into the externals of the form of it, then that would be the ass-like. Because the asses just carry stuff around. You put a bunch of stuff on their back, they carry it around. They don't know why. Right? You can't, donkey wouldn't know why he's carrying around, you know, a bunch of bricks on his back. Right? Well, the swan, you give it something, it'll go for the essence. But, so that's the point, is that general historians are donkeys carrying around unlimited volume of useless facts and figures. Well, the swan-like men will go in and then what is actually of use in the history, take that out, because that is also valuable for us today. Because there's always something from what people have done in the past that's still useful today. Because the material energy doesn't change. You know, Brahma makes that point very clear in the Manasamhita, is that nothing is different today than it was millions of years ago, than it was in the last universe or the universe before that. It's all exactly the same. You know, concept of a dog is the same in every universe, at every age, at every time. The 8,400,000 don't change. you know, the 14 planetary systems, what goes on, you know, eating, sleeping, mating, defending, you know, your politics, your music, it's exactly the same. Because it's coming from the Veda. Veda is Aparusheya. So it's fixed. That's why it's chewing the tube. So going through the activity is nothing special, but the particular purpose of consciousness is. You know, so for us, we're trying to get to the transcendental. So that would be very important. While the mundane scholars, and they're simply just, you know, it's interesting. It's just that, you know, some facts that are kind of like interesting. You know, like kids go out and play in the garden, like the rocks or the leaves or the grass. It's interesting. It has no meaning. But it's just, it catches the attention. So for somebody, you know, the Egyptian history catches the attention. For someone else, it's the Chinese. For someone else, it's, you know, some little aspect of the, what is it, the Huguenots or something like that. Or, you know, Huguenots, you know, I think they were a group of Christians that had some devotional inclination that was considered heretical, and so then they were all, you know, burned at the stake or something, you know, or something like that. So, you know, and then you get into finer detail. So that's ass-like, because you're just carrying around the burden of facts and figures. Like that. Well, the other one just gets down to the essence, takes that and doesn't bother with the rest. It's not important, you know. Unless it adds to something, it doesn't matter, you know. It's like the king was doing this. You don't really necessarily tell what he's wearing unless it's significant to understand the mood. Like he's going out on you know, in state, so then it's like, okay, then he had this crown on and he's wearing this and that. Then you can understand how regal it was. You know, or the girl was there and, you know, the sage saw her. So unless it's important, it doesn't describe what she looks like or what she's wearing, you know, like that. So these things are there, but then when you get into the whole things, you know, it's like, you know, the Urvasi came, the Urabas, and oh, what kind of sari was she wearing? You know, which shop did she buy it at? You know, that's useless. You know, that's not the point of the story. Does that make sense? So he's trying to bring that out, is that for those ass-like persons who get distracted by all these useless facts, these are techniques that you can use to throw them off so they'll actually listen to the essence. So that's what the thing is doing. But in doing that, he's giving, one has to study it very carefully, in that he never in any way compromises our philosophy. He just cleverly uses word juggler to our advantage. You know, in other words, you have so many, not word juggler, let's say semantics. And because of the semantics, there are different meanings. So he would use a word that the popular usage would be one way, but its actual meaning, you know, etymological meaning, actually could be something completely different that supports what we're saying. So in other words, he would choose words or examples that would make them comfortable, but at the same time we know the actual hidden meaning of it. You know? So like that. So because the fact's not important. You say something that appears to them that it's a fact that's important, but actually you're not distracting the attention. You know, it's like you say, what about the Saptarishis? Oh, there's some kings. Great kings. They'll use great kings. Great king, Maharaj. You know, so it's, you know, like that. So they're sages. So all the sages, Brahmins are Maharaj. So, like that. So there's some great kings. Oh, okay. Finished. They'll be sages. No, yeah, they're there and they're on those, you know, the Big Dipper, that's where they live and all that. They won't listen to me. But it's just like, you know, but you know, it's contradictions. That's the whole thing. Is they always see it's contradictions. Everything in life is a contradiction, right? The scientist, the physicist says there is no mind, but he's really worried about, you know, what his wife is, if she's upset or not. You know? Like that. His life depends on his wife's mind, and he's sitting there saying, there is no mind. You know, so like that. So contradiction is, you know, what's going on. But just they don't notice that. They're too dull. They're donkeys. They're busy carrying around all this other information and simple things like that they don't have. But it's very, very, you have to very, very carefully deal with this, because there appears to be a class of mentality that is, that they themselves, maybe they have faith in what Prabhupada says, you know, but they don't have the conviction how to put that across to the karmi world, and especially the academic world. They do have somehow or another a reverence for the academic field, and they feel that they are actually personages of respect. You know, one, they're very intelligent, organized, you know, so these aspects, one has to give them their due. But as far as actually understanding things when it comes to, you know, Indology, you know, it's they wouldn't know. So sometimes devotees are very uncomfortable there, or politically correctness, you know, about what Prabhupada will say. So they're very happy to find a method that we can just throw it out. So you have to be very, very careful in introducing this technique, that it in no way is being thrown out, because it should be, you can take, if they can't take what they're, the example that they're using, and explain it so it one allays the, you know, doubts of the karmas. And at the same time, if you use the same example or words to fully explain our philosophy, then they've got the wrong, they've missed the point. If it only allays the fears of others but doesn't support us, then it's atheistic. Like that. So you have to be very, very careful, because it's sometimes, you know, in the academic or communications world, they're really worried about what we say. They probably will go into anybody and talk and get the work done. You know, he would be able to, he shows the technique. You know, it's like that one, you know, how you say, very liberal, feminine, how you say that, feminist journalist. She's coming and talking about these things and all that, and, you know, kind of like trying to catch, you know, using the donkey method of trying to catch on a point that's not actually important. And then, you know, she was wearing a mini skirt and all that. And so then Prabhupada did at the end just said, you know, better a, you know, cool head and warm legs, you know. Because cool head is something that in the West is valuable, right? You know, he has a cool head and he's fixed up. So just doing that, it just throws in a joke and throws the thing out the window, because it's not something worth talking about. You know? Or it's like he was on one show and I think the guy was talking about, you know, so you know, you guys, you know, you wear these clothes and all that, and you know, something like that, and you know, but you're wearing, you know, this, you know, orange and all that. And it says, hey, it doesn't matter, it's, you know, it's a color like this. Oh, so it could be anything like this, basically he's saying, you know. Oh, so it could be any color, blue or green. And Prabhupada goes, yes, yes, saffron. You know. And the guy doesn't really catch it, because he's got his point. Oh, you could wear anything, but you just happen to wear this color, you know. You know? Or another one where it was some talk show, popular talk show, where this guy invites people onto the show and then makes a fool out of them. And then, you know, the American public loves that kind of stuff. So it was this guy, he thought he was going to get Prabhupada on being, you know, anti-American. You know, because, you know, down on, you know, the American values and this and that. So then, I forget how he approached it. He asked this really loaded question right in the beginning. It's an hour-long show. Right in the beginning, about something, I don't know, about the kids or this or that, you know, and in such a way that it made it look anti-American. And Prabhupada just goes, yes, Americans, you know, such a nice, you know, culture. You can see from the parents, you know, we have such nice students. So, you know, a good, you know, the good son is symptomatic of a good mother. So they must be such good mothers to have such nice sons. And the guy didn't know, had any idea what to say after that. It also is that you say it so you don't leave anything open for them to grab onto. You know? And for the rest of the show, he just let Tara do the talking. And, oh, what is this? And what do you do that? And, you know, this guy that's, you know, Mr. Confident and harassing everybody, just sitting there submissive. And so in this, I would say, as you take from this and then go into these, a lot of these Prabhupada speaks out and these kind of things, go into conversations and like that, and show from there examples of how Prabhupada's doing it. You know, because Bhaktivinoda Thakur is doing it, you know, in the 1830s, 1850s, like this. So when all the intellectuals are there and this new, and, but there is the concept, the ideal and this and that and noble and all that. So he could use it in a way that would work for them. The principle works today, but the particular language and that, the examples, might you find work today, might you might have to adjust a little bit, but the principle is that's there. The problem is showing how to deal today with the modern, like that. So to show that principle is that through using cleverness and logic, you just distract them from, it's like a baby. The baby starts doing something wrong, then those who don't know how to deal with them stop them from doing the thing that they're doing. Then the kid cries. Those who are more clever, they're doing something wrong, and then instead of stopping them, they show them something else that will attract their attention. They know what attracts attention and how to get it. They just distract them from the thing that they're doing wrong. So they didn't have to tell them no, they just took them away from them. Because they're not mature enough to understand. So even though they're supposedly very intelligent, they're not mature enough to actually understand, you know, these things, because they can't accommodate. If they can't see it with their senses, they don't believe it. And even if they see it with their senses, they still don't believe it. You know, it's like, you know, you dig down, you pull out, you know, how you say, you know, a modern man's skull that is, you know, 100 million years older than, you know, Homo erectus, and they won't believe it. They'll just try to use your intelligence to find out, oh, well, there was a crack in the thing, and so even from a higher level, it fell down into the lower level. You know, that's what they always do. They find something, they always write it off. So even if they see it, they don't believe it. So then this way, then you get down to the essence, you know. You know, so that's one. Once you have headway, and especially if you have, you know, people behind you, then you start using it, just bluntly going in there and smashing it to bits, like Sadaputta and Drutakarma, like that. Because amongst the guys in the chair, they hate him. But all the young scientists and everybody else and that, and, you know, all these new age groups and that, they're considered the top authorities, like in Western America. You know, it's like they are the authorities when it comes to subtle things and UFOs and this and that. So whenever they have stuff, they call them. So as far as, you know, the vast reaching and the younger, you know, scientists and that, then they're fine. But the old fogies in the chair, you know, like that, what's that guy? Leaky and those guys like that, you know, they really freaked out by them. You know? So, but you got a headway. Once you get in, then you can do that. But otherwise, it's because you're getting something. You're getting people behind it. But the point is to get people behind it. So if you have to go in a very clever way, you know, like you're talking to people and you talk about the supreme, or what do you call it? The divine, what do you call it? What is it? Yes, it's intelligent design. So that's as far as they can handle that. You don't talk beyond that. You know what I'm saying? You just talk that. Mm. Does that make sense? Mm. You just talk that, and then they're happy. But then from there, then you show logically how it's there now and again, then you might throw in God, and then you go back, and this and that. And like that. Like what we did with the students at the Bhakti. We just talked about Supreme and this and that in the beginning. And somehow by the end, and we're discussing, you know, the four different personality types of Godhead, you know, like that, and how that comes down into the psychology of our own personal life. You know? So our psychology, what happens to us is based on the personality of God, like that. So by the last day, it could just be discussed straight, like that. You know, we're not saying you surrender anything. We're just discussing it in relation to psychology, and that there's a direct connection between God and how He thinks and acts and what happens here. But in the beginning, we didn't use that. It was just all, you know, supreme and there's higher, that kind of thing, higher consciousness, and, you know, all this kind of stuff that they're more comfortable with. Rameshwar was very expert at that. He was very expert at that. Prabhupada once said he was the most intelligent. Like that. I heard him give a lecture once to all, I think it was like professional, you know, New Agey and academic, like this kind of level of people. And he just took them up through this whole thing, you know, the sages of India about this. He just took them through a logical sequence of how you would go through the stages of that and related to the sages and, you know, and their meditation and, you know, all this kind of thing. And it worked very well. Okay. But it's a delicate point, very dangerous. It's an expert, it's just like a knife. It can do excellent work, but it can be very damaging. So in the wrong hands, it's damaging. So you have to be very careful. There's always the caveat that it never in any way are they just debunking our philosophy and culture. But they're just very cleverly skirting it without going against it. Otherwise, devotees have too much of a tendency to not understand it by their own sentiment or misgivings. Then they will actually go against their philosophy. So where to now?
Yeah. So there's already a curriculum for this one semester history course,
okay,
which tackles, I mean, as I told you, that first we just start with the latent Western approach to iconology, and after that, just show how the whole concept of history in the West is being questioned nowadays. Mm. And after that, we go to the Prabhupada approach. Mm-hmm. And I'm just thinking how to integrate what we have with Krishna Sambhita's introduction into this, because it's a very nice approach.
Mm-hmm.
And so
mm-hmm.
far this is the only one I found as a historical treatise.
Yeah, I would do that and show the technique, how it's used by Prabhupada.
Yeah.
You know, so just a few examples so they get the idea that what's going on like that. Yeah, because that would generally be the thing, is that in the modern, and most people don't know, the Vedas haven't read. But Bhaktivinoda Thakura would be talking to people who have read, who've grown up in families where this is their culture. But because they have now been so-called enlightened by British education, then they start to doubt or move away. You know, it's like the same, like our own devotees who then become academics, then they have a tendency to do exactly the same thing. You know, I've had discussions with our own academics, and I'll just mention a point that's just normal for us, and immediately they go, oh, that's very subjective. And this, you know, it's like it's a point of even discussion, you know, where it has nothing to do with that. You know, like you say, that the loss of semen, you know, is connected to the brain, like that. And then immediately, well, that's subjective, you know, because modern science, so-called, hasn't come across that. Though since the 30s, they've known all this stuff, but it's just not. They just put it aside because it's not something they want to deal with. But you know, immediately it came up as a topic of discussion, you know, of doubt and maybe and you know maybe we'll be fanatic or you know like that. So. It's a danger here, yes. Because we're running it ourselves. We don't have to use their think, so you can avoid that. But in establishing yourself as an academic, you know, authority, other schools which may not take that, like the Oxford Project, I think very much they will take the the modern academic thing, because they're trying to fit in. They really have a respect that Oxford is something of substance, rather than people think it's substance, therefore working. But unfortunately, Cambridge is now the number one university, not Oxford. You know, so as it is, they're still in with number two instead of before. You know, because the idea is you have Harvard, you have Yale, you have Oxford, you have Cambridge, but of all of those, Oxford is like considered the most prestigious. But now it's dropped. So it's, but they actually think it's a valuable system. For us, it's just, it is a tool, an area that we can teach through. You know, because they're smart people, and if you can catch these people, they influence everybody else. You know, so it's just like you get political leaders, you get the academics, you get the business people, you get the celebrities. You know, and there, you can see they change the society. But it's not that celebrity dumb. You know, or dumb celebrities. It's not that that's important. You know, what's important is the influence they could have because of their position. But the medium itself is not of any importance. You know, just like the Vedic is not important unless it's connected to Krishna. So we're neither bewildered by the Western nor by the Vedic. You know, sometimes pro-Vedic, it means that, oh, we just push that and against this. No, we're against anything that's not connected to Krishna. Does that make sense? So that means that we're creating a very different kind of academic. You know, our academics then, you know, are just as intelligent as the others, but because they actually know conclusion, their knowledge is actually solid, it's real. While the others, yes, very high quality and intelligence misused or misdirected. Some of these people are geniuses. You know, if somehow or another they could come to the proper understanding, what they could do would be amazing.
So do you agree that some part of the Krishna Samhita could be used?
Oh, definitely. I think it would be very good. Well, I'm just saying, just be very careful about it. But if you go in and analyze it and pick it apart so they actually understand, take each example and show how that, what, I mean, in other words, put it into context, how that would allay their doubts and how it would also support our philosophy, but through a hidden way. And if you can do that and all the examples, then they'll catch the principle.
Mm. And I really like that. Bhaktivinoda Thakur wrote it in 1859. It was really up to date to that history writing. I mean, that was the beginning of official, or professional history. Because Planck had started it in Germany, and he put emphasis on two things, chronology and the critique of sources. And that's what Bhaktivinoda Thakur keeps saying, that I give present now the modern approach to history, and he gives an argument on chronology, and he gives an argument on the critique of the sources.
So he's why that's important. Why that's important.
Just to catch their attention, because as soon as he finishes a chapter or something, he immediately goes to the 12 principles of the Sambandha Vidya Prayasana of the Jiva, how he can go to the Krishna Prosperity of Gautama, and he keeps going back to the S-life, form-life, differentiating what introduces life in the beginning of the 80s. Mm-hmm. So it's like, it's very interesting that he uses a really up-to-date method for this period, but at the same time, chronology will affect our philosophical method.
Because the same thing, chronology to us means chronology of, because for us we use chronology, but in Purana, it's not actually the date. The chronology is the presentation. Just like last day. I mean, we've used it before, but in the class, that you always get somebody who loves to ask these, who take the floor and ask these 5 minute, you know, very, how you say, mentally or intellectually or emotionally kind of like meandering questions that may or may not get to the, you know, the actual source, but it doesn't matter because the real taste is just having the floor and sharing your mind with everybody in the room. So then we just stop this person who had a great proclivity at this and explain to them. I didn't tell them what it was, but just explain to them Panchanganyaya. Is that you have to be able to state your question in one sentence. You can't say it in one sentence, you don't know what you're asking. Because any question can be asked in one sentence. Then, because it needs some backup or clarification, that's the second part. Then, in the next sentences, you clarify. Because once you've said, then we know what you're talking about. Otherwise, you talk for 5 minutes, we don't know what you're talking about, everyone gets bored. But if we know what you're talking about, then for 5 minutes, it's nice. And then you can give after that, then you get into your history and examples and all those kind of things. Because that's the chronology, how thought goes. You know, that's the nyaya. So that's the essential, the panchanga nyaya. So how to keep it on that, and what are the techniques you use within these bodies. You know, it's just like someone gives an example and then you want to cut that example, you might use, there's so many techniques. You know, or their example is good, but you have nothing about it, and you start jalpa. You know, you just start just talking stuff that has nothing to do, you know, I think we call it filibustering. You know, or stonewalling. You know, it's just you just put up a point and just don't let it go past, though it is a logical thing. Or you just start talking here and there and taking up the space until people get sick of it and then it moves on. You know? So there are that, or nigrahastan, where you just come in and just, you know, squash it. The method you use is so severe and so clear and cutting that you just destroy the other person. So you have so many. But these are all within the Panchanga Nyaya. So then, we mentioned that, and then it would work. So chronology is important for us, because that's actually what the Puranic is chronological. Like that. But generally, what it is, a chronology of presentation of the philosophy. It's a chronology of the thought pattern. But example may come here and there, because you're giving history as an example, you know, and then he says, and sources. So we're very sticky about sources. It must be from the Veda, it must be from the Acharyas, like that. It must be according to the scriptures. You know, it must be logical. Like that. So we're the same. But it's just that, so here again, he's doing what they think. But they mean it one way, they mean it in that ass way. And we're presenting chronology and critique of sources from the Swarmai. So it's the same thing. And he's saying, yes, we prefer this. But it makes it sound like he's dumping the old, the Vedic, and taking the modern. But what he's doing is now presenting what is the essence of the Swan, essence of the Vedas. Like that. So it's very clever in how he's using his words and presentation and the air about it. You know, he even can take on the air of the academic and that and stuff like that. So it's very, you know, it's just like, you know, says, you know, we're looking in all these directions and it's useless, we should go back to the Vedas and everything like that. And the academics would just say, you know, what friend is this guy from? You know, but I was studying all these things and that, and then one day I came across, looking for answers, and then I came across reading the Bhagavatam, and I was seeing that there's some really nice points here, you know, that would apply today, even though it's an old thing, but the, you know, truth is always fresh. So I'm thinking we should take a fresh view on the Bhagavatam, and maybe there's something of essence there that will be useful. That's how he presents it. So it's intriguing to the mind of the academics. So then they think, yes, you know, okay, yeah, we could look at this. So in other words, you know their language, you know their mentality, and you use that to your advantage. You know, it's just that's means you have a, what do you call it? So many of these martial systems, the really developed ones that are like combinations of so many of them, There's someone who's really a master who combines because he's taking the essence. One of the major things of them is you don't apply any of your own energy. You just use the other person's energy to his own advantage. They go to hit you, you know, then instead of just you block it and this and that, he's already hit you, so that means he's off balance. So if they go to punch you, you could try to block this and then punch him back. He's already put the energy. You just have to, with your fingers, just pull him. And he's off balance. And then once you've pulled him, you can push him anywhere you want. You know what I'm saying? So, in other words, you use their energy and their method to get them. You know, it's like, what do you call it, you know? You have so many, I guess, Western kind of, in the case of like, you know, I can't think of them. There's a few of them, but the, you know, we don't use them, so it doesn't. Frying a fish in its own, I forget. You know, in other words, you're cooking it in its own fat, yeah. So that's the whole point. So in other words, you defeat the academics using their own method. Yeah, that's the point. Does that make sense? So that's why he can take it from the one, present it so clearly, and then, because they don't know, because it is consistent, he can just transform it into ours. And then take the next point from the academic and this, and singing, throwing everything out, and then as he goes and talks, he's present the logic, so he asks you, or accepted it, then he transforms it back into ours again. That's what I'm saying is the method of writing, seemingly writing off the old, you know, how you say, archaic, Vedic, you know, concepts are actually just, are not doing that. They're just presenting it through their language so they accept it, and then it leaves it open to take it back into their Vedic. So devotees will write the one thing off and then go into this. No, but then they'll be discussing modern methods. No, he's not. He's discussing Vedic methods. But he starts with the one and then transforms it into the other. So it's very, very, very clever. Does that make sense?
But and the other good thing is, like, I don't like the term, but postmodern approaches to history are quite similar to the Vedic ones. Yeah. Because there are two main points, there are several main points, but I'd like to stress here is that they say that everything depends on the interpretation. Mm-hmm. So everything has to be put into context. Any source, any written or any oral source, mm-hmm. must be put into context. Mm-hmm. Which means when the interpretation is never objective, it always depends on consciousness. Mm-hmm. They don't make that step. They don't pronounce consciousness, but mm-hmm. it's very similar mm-hmm. to the Vedic. Mm-hmm.
So then you come in and say, you know, it means that this would be the way to approach. Is that up to this time then it was all this way, you know, up to the mid-1800s then history was like this. Then in the 1850s then they started the modern approach of like this and whatever it is, and you know, chronology and your sources, critique of sources. But now it has been seen that then you show the weakness of that. You know, in other words, what postmodern says. The weaknesses are this, but they also are in line with what we say. So to choose words and terminologies that would support it both ways. Then once you introduce it, it has to be in the context and according to according to the people that it was dealing with and all that, how do they view it and all that. Then you go into like that, and then from there you take it into, you show the point, and then that, and there take it into ours. So it's the same principle, even though you may be reversing. Bhaktivinoda was using what was modern. So, haven't found a name for postmodern yet? Because I heard now that some circles are in post-postmodern.
Yeah, but it's the problem is with the term of postmodern that it neglects something but doesn't give it's an 1880. So it says it's not modern anymore, it's after modern, but it doesn't give a definition of what it is. It just says what it is not.
Okay, but they're not working on a new term.
What they use in social science is linguistic term. Which happened in the 60s and the 70s, which meant that, you know, when 2 weeks ago, we discussed with the search of the perfect language. At first, it was mathematical language, but the interesting thing is that from the early 19th century up to the late 20th century, everything was related, all the metaphors were taken for physics and chemistry and biology, so the natural sciences, they were considered as superior. But since they couldn't have any to resolve any philosophical or social questions, in the 60s and the 70s, they turned to the linguistics again. So they considered that everything is a language, which is very similar to the Vedic as well. And that's why the linguistic term means that all the metaphors, all the similes, what they use in social and social sciences and humanities come from linguistics, context. Interpretation, hermeneutics.
Because for us, is your hermeneutics is your mimamsa. That's important. And then you have to have the context. So for us, always. In other words, anything that they find that works is actually ours. You know, ultimately. But because they don't know the actual. They don't have the actual, you know, mimamsa and this and that. They don't really know what's going on. They can't quite get it right. So, because it doesn't answer all the questions, they throw it out for something else. Like, they'll say time is everything. But there's also, how you say? Because there's always two things. You have the rasa, and you have time. Because time is the application of it. You have the experience that's gained, the exchange, right? The desire and the needs, you know, the attraction and attachment for interaction. You know, your elements of the rasa. But then you have to apply that. And so when you apply that, that's time. So that's mathematics. You know, like you have a raga, right? Which is the notes that will create the mood. But then you have the tal, which is how it is the math, how it will be applied. Like that. So actually, the time is in support of or to obtain what the mood is. So math as a language is fine, but it's the abhidhaya aspect. Or it can be also sambandha, because you know you're calculating what is there. But in other words, if you take a combination of linguistics and math, then you have something. Right? So you have to have rasa. You know, in other words, for us, then it's rasa and tattva. By the tattva, you know where everything falls in their interaction, but when you operate it, that's rasa. You know, that's what you're going to get out of it. That makes sense?
Yeah.
So it's... That's the problem, is that they catch one aspect of it. You know, like always the eternal battle, I don't know other languages, but in English, you know, is it phonetic approach or, you know, linguistic, I think. And each of them has their reasons, but the Vedic means, if they both had certain solid things, the Vedic would be both. And you'd find, which is expert in one area, you'd use it for that. Because it is weak in the other, otherwise why did the other side have such good arguments. So what's good in the one, you use that, and what's good in the other, you combine it, but they can never do that. You know, Maya takes away their intelligence. So the Vedic is the combination of them. You know, it's just like the eternal thing, do you put the knowledge in, or do you draw it out? You know, so the old is you just stuff it in, and the modern is you somehow or another try to draw it out of the trigger. I don't know, but whatever. So, but the Vedics, you do both, because you can't draw out until you put something in. Like, until you charge the body battery, you can't get any, you know, energy out. So you're trying to, your purpose is to draw out, but you have to put in to get draw out. But they'll think, no, if I want to draw out, I got to start drawing out right from the beginning. You know, like your, who are these guys? German Steiner schools and these kinds of things. They create kids that have amazing imaginations. Huh? Waldorf and Steiner, all these amazing imaginations. But they cannot connect with reality. They are so far, they are so socially dysfunctional, those kids. They can't relate because whatever is in their imagination for them becomes the reality. So they can't connect it to what's outside, you know. Like that. We've had kids come in, geniuses. They can't function in our school because they have to be able to hit the ground, you know. You know, and then the mind is, you know, the great martial artists and this and all that and imagining. But, you know, the guy has no coordination. And then because of that, then they lose their whole identity and the whole, you know, psychological crisis. And then they have to go home. And then, you know, the school's the bad guys because we didn't support their, you know, it's kind of like, hey, you know, so like that. Maybe we should put that on a form. Have you ever been to a Steiner or Waldorf school? You know, so does that make sense? Is that they're able to get something, but they miss it. So the thing is, the Vedas is put the logic in first. Once logic's gone in and they think logically, then add art. Because then their art will also be logical. You know, there'll be a logic to their art. Otherwise, you know, you get something that doesn't necessarily make sense. You know? Like that. Like you take something like Picasso. People copy Picasso and all that, but nobody will buy it for $100 million. That's because it's art on art. Right? But Picasso, they'll buy because actually it's logic, and then on top of that, he's applied his particular perspective of art. Yeah. Means Picasso could paint a perfectly normal painting, classic painting. And knowing those principles, he's applied his particular, you know, unique perspective. You know? But these other people couldn't paint a normal painting if you pay them. You know, and so then, therefore, their art doesn't mean anything. So, art only has meaning when it's based on science. So that will be the thing, is that as this changes, because the modern is always going to change. So then, in your academy, you always have to address that. So it's just whatever the cutting edge is, it doesn't matter because whatever they say, we agree with also, but in context of the Vedas. And they've just seen this. This has been applied. This theory is applied. There's a defect here, so we have to change, address that defect. So therefore, the neti principle. Then they work out what addresses that defect. But in doing that, sometimes they lose what was the value of the other thing. Right? In other words, there was a reason in the mid 1800s that they decided on the chronology and the checking of material because they probably had things that didn't make sense. Completely out of order, wasn't logical, and who knows where it was from, this, you know, rumor. So then there had to be, as we have to see it, and we have to put it in order, you know. Where's that Puna book? You know, because otherwise you get funny things, you know, which is supposedly based on those guys that are following that principle. But it doesn't make any sense because they don't themselves according to their own, you know, this.
Now, if you look at this, these all look like monkeys here. This guy doesn't. What's he doing there?
That is a dead end. Mm-hmm. It was a dead end.
A dead end. But the point is it shows that, you know, some of these things are there. Because this guy looks the most like this guy. Actually, he looks better than this guy. You know? So that's the difficulty, is that this doesn't make sense. So chronology is important. You know? So, like that, but at the same time, it's a dead end, huh? He was ahead of his time, right? The girls couldn't appreciate it. Had a thin nose. I wouldn't think. Or he was too gentle. He couldn't go out and pluck the girls over the head, so he never got married. So. Yeah, he just died out.
So that's the thing, is that whatever they're saying, whatever their theories are, in one sense, the essence of it, we also agree with. But their interpretation of it and their particular application of it, much of the time will be atheistic. But the essence of it is the same, because it is knowledge, and knowledge comes from God. Just they interpret it wrong. So we take their same thing, use the term how they use it, but we mean it the way we do. So in our description, we never contradict our philosophy. But at the same time, is to them, they think we're talking their language. Right? You say that, you know, we want this thing, and then they immediately think, oh, he's more modern, he's throwing this out. He didn't throw it out. That's their perspective. You know, therefore, at the end of the chapter, he brings it completely around to what we're saying. So that's his point. He start with what they're saying and then bring it around. Right? But it's fully connected. You know, because it's like, because if you're taking everything down, sabandhavide and prayojana, everything's always connected. Doesn't matter what subject matter it is. So you can start from one and take it through to another, or start in one and seemingly you're describing one thing, but you can take it to the other side, because you know how those were. Does that make sense? Yeah. That's good. So that principle has to be there, and that they understand as a principle, because otherwise you're going to show Bhaktivinoda course when he's showing at the beginning of like the modern, but then now it's the end of the modern. You know? And so then the principle is the same, but you know, he was addressing that time and I were addressing this time. So we'll use the same principle but in this approach. Like that. But if we know we're talking to older professors who are still, you know, archaic, you know, like that, you know, then you'll use Bhaktivinoda Thakur's points just as they are. But if you're dealing with the younger ones who are more into the post-modern, then you're going to use this other approach. It's the same thing.
The thing is that what is taught as history in schools, that's really archaic, so that's chronology, and very critical of the sources. But what is discovered at the academia or at the university, that's from the postmodern.
Well, that's nice.
When the problem is that when we face, I mean, when we meet the students here, they are taught what, for them, what history is, that's boring chronology, most of them. Mm-hmm. So that's why Bhaktivinoda Thakur is very useful, can be very useful for them.
Oh, okay.
But at the same time, there can be, you can use the tool,
yeah,
by saying that even modern history is doubt. I mean, doubting its sources, mm-hmm, its time, mm-hmm, its beginning, all this. Mm-hmm. So that's why there are questions of modern historiography, mm-hmm, which are very similar to those raised by Bhaktivinoda Thakur. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that's a very fortunate period, because now in Western academia, that's a period of doubt. So nothing is certain, everything is made up. Yeah,
sure. If we would just preach strongly, then it would come around. But that's the thing, we preach strong enough to unhinge their confidence, but then we get caught up amongst ourselves. If we were just united and could preach strongly, then it would just come around to our side. Because you know, it's like, no one can doubt our ability to deal with any subject and answer any question like that. They just, because devotees are only focused on that, it hasn't been an idea how to apply that in the individual's life. You know, because generally it's like, applying your life means just, you know, shave up, moving to the temple. There's no concept of how you're an academic, you're sitting in the university, or you're a professional, you're sitting there, you're just a common guy, kind of job. How in that you can be fully Krishna conscious. It's a change in the consciousness. It means if they change the consciousness to see that whatever they're doing has to have, you know, it has some reason behind it. And most people are unconscious why they do the things they do. You know what I'm saying? So you make them conscious of what they're doing. And then you show through the Vedic, you know, metaphysics how all that connects back to the Lord. Then they can be God conscious in their situations. And naturally, as they become purified, they will prefer pure metaphysical and physical environments than they are already in. Does that make sense? Means that, let us say, they're in kind of more of a, you know, tamasic kind of environment. But they can see all the elements of it in connection to Krishna. So they become Krishna conscious. As they become purified, they'll start to prefer being in more pure environments. They'll move up to the passion, up to goodness, and then eventually, you know, up to transcendence. But if their consciousness is corrected, the other will follow, as long as you take the consciousness all the way through. But generally devotees just take it that, okay, you chant, you take the shot, that's good, but you could also take whatever you're doing, see, in connection with God. You know, you are a physicist, you are doing, but then it's God's creation, how does it work? There is a science to it. But, you know, like this, and seeing these aspects, or how he dresses, he wears this, you know, kind of sloppy three-piece suit. You know, that's because he has to fit in. Why do you have to fit in? Because it means God's created the concept of social, and so therefore being part of something is where you find your identity, your needs. So just as an individual, as a human, that is necessary. Everybody does that. Even the dogs do it, and everybody has that. So therefore, that's because it's coming from God. So therefore, it's fine that you're wearing your three-piece suit because you're fitting into that environment. So then with time, they become purified. They'd rather fit into a more, you know, a different environment. Does that make sense?
And that means that he wouldn't encourage them to, like, you know, move to the temple and change their...
You don't have to. In the beginning, that'll come on its own. You just present it. That's the point. If we're always doing it, and then they start to have faith in us, then they'll want to know what you're doing and how they can be part rather than we've told them. It's come from them. You know? Like that. That's what these kind of people, professional, intellectual, these kind of like this, they already think. So you just have to get them. Because for them, the lifestyle matches what they're doing. So if they prefer something, they'll change it. No problem, they'll be committed to it. You know? That simpler people off the street and all this and that, then that's another thing, is that you can do that with, it means, depending, if they're too dull, then you leave them where they are, and if they're not, so it just depends upon how it'll work, and if it will actually work for them. Prabhupada didn't move George Harrison into the temple. He wanted to. He was ready to shave out and move into the temple. Prabhupada said no. You know, not because, you know, some other ulterior motive, or we're going to get more out of it. No, it's because he himself wouldn't have made it in the temple anyway. And then to have such an important person involved with the movement, you wouldn't want to have him uninvolved with the movement. Mm. You know, like that. So therefore, he's involved in his, in a capacity. He can be involved and he's happy. Mm. And so then it's there. And then he writes so many records and this and that, and means they did that memorial for him. Mm. It means Lenin died, they didn't have a memorial. Mm-hmm. Right? You know? You know, so, and he died, and then you have this whole stage of all these, you know, prominent musicians all chanting Hare Krishna. And they're doing it on their own. It's not a Hare Krishna devotee up there. They're telling the guy to chant. They're all just and they're all comfortably chanting, so you can see they've done it before. Mm. You know, and he's a devotee, so they're glorifying a devotee. So even though some of it's a bit indirect, but whatever, they're doing glorification of a devotee. So then so much has been accomplished.
Do you think that he's kind of mature enough to preach in that way as well? Because I don't really...
There's some individuals, yes, but in general, no. But it's that feels only worth going into when there's maturity. Because the point is you turn those people off, then it's not like one person that you burnt out on the street because the way you dealt with them. Here, it's people who are influential, and they all talk, they all know each other. You know, it is a community. Once you get up at a certain level, it is a community. You know, and so then because you don't want to turn them against Krishna consciousness like that, because, you know, it's not a lack of sincerity. Because they're only born in, actually, you're only born in this kind of position because of previous devotional service. That's probably not known by devotees in general or at all, but probably says it right in the sixth canto. You difficulties. You know, you don't end up in those positions without having done some service. Well, some of them it's even more. You know, so it's like this one, I don't know, we were talking about it here, someone else. Bill Gates at one thing revealed that for some time he was eating at the temple or something. Mm-hmm. He had no food, nothing. This is before he started. No, not Bill Gates. Was it the Apple guy?
Apple guy.
Yeah, the Jobs guy.
Yeah, but Bill Gates is used to go to Hare Krishna temples.
Yeah, so...
But the other one revealed it.
Yeah.
The Macintosh guy revealed it.
Yeah, yeah. So the stories like this are Boy George. He was on time 2 weeks on the street in King's Cross in Australia, in Sydney. Nothing. And he would eat it. And he said, well, he said if it wasn't for the food for life there, he would have died.
You know.
Like that. That's why he did that big program for the devotees in Russia, at Moscow. 30,000 weeks after it. It's big. Like that, just an appreciation. Like that. So they've all done something, either this life, previous life. Otherwise, you don't get in that. You know, otherwise, what can you do that would project you into something that big? Unless you did like an ashram, maybe yagya. Even then, you know. So it's only devotion. So sometimes devotees are a little bit also not, or don't think about it. Just have that faith that. Anything that goes on in this world that actually has any meaning is only because there's a backing of bhakti behind it. You know, like that. So something delicate, it comes with time, it has to come.
Is it the same with the politicians and anybody who's failed?
Basically, specifically when they're born, probably specifically means when they're born into these situations. But we can also see is when they get into these situations, something's been done. Otherwise, how is it going to go, you know, come in contact? Yeah, I mean, people were, before Prabhupada went to America, people were chanting Hare Krishna in America. But they didn't have proper connection. You know, the people down in India and picked it up from some, you know, Babas and Vrindavan, you know, Gurus and like that. Allen Ginsberg was chanting Hare Krishna back in the 50s. You know, so it's like these things are, it's there, but it's kind of out of the way. So anything that's actually going on anyway, is because of devotees. So you can't turn them against the devotees. That would be a disservice. Better leave them alone, and then that agape secrete will mature at some other time. Then go in and destroy it for them. You know. That's probably why Krishna keeps us out of that field. Because we can't just go and deal with them as the normal people. That's what they appreciate. Like George Harrison was comfortable with Mukunda and I forget who was it, and Shamasun, because they would just deal with them just as a person. But other devotees, hey, you know, George Harrison this and that, and always advertise them and say this, that, and just kind of like use his position and name. For preaching, nice, but then you kind of, the person actually wonders, am I important or is it just my position's important? Well, they deal with him as a person. It says, we don't care about your position, you're important. You know, and then they'll use their position to get things done. You know, when he was always favorable, you know, devotees come and, you know, come to his concert or something to sell books and all that. And they would ask him, you know, what do you think of these crazy guys? I just let them do what they want. you know, they're nuts, leave them alone, you know, like that. So. Generally, he'd sell the Krishna books, got his name in it. So. Yes.
The other good thing is that you know, more and more persons now, and especially this is not just postmodern, but the way post-nationalistic period as well, what we witness, and that's why they go back, historians go back to the beginning of professional history, and saying that maybe we should forget all these national interpretations of history, and rather we should go back to the Greek or Roman period, like Tutadit, who wrote the parallel biographies. And his point was similar to the Vedic point. He said that it's not the period or the details which count. What he did, he just put two famous personalities, biography next to each other. Even they live really in different remote places from each other and different periods, and he just showed the similarities and basically their karma. I mean, what was the causality in their life? So how their previous deeds led to one step to another, and now more and more. And now more and more history teachers and historians say that maybe we should just forget this modern approach to history based on differences, and we should go back teaching rather than the example, human example. So I mean, that's why it's really interesting that this is really up to date as well. So the swan-like, S-like approach, so those who differentiate and those who find the try to find the generalities of general truth in the past is up to date now again.
That's
so
nice. Is there any forum where whatever is kind of the latest in the various academic fields can be found? What are the theories that they're basing it on?
On the internet, you mean, or there's HNet for historians.
So
time to time, the thing is that the field is so much different groups don't really communicate with each other, so always have to know which is like the best university. So it can be Manchester for 2 months, and after Paris, Yale again. So they just follow, and they time to time they organize conferences on these matters, and after that they publish a book. And for a certain set of time, that book is the Bible of new ideas. But after that, the new group organizes a new conference, and they publish the lectures there, and that's the most interesting. So you just have to follow all the time. And there's such an abundance of reviews that you are supposed to read and spend at least 2 days of your week in the library just to
check.
But there's nothing novel in that. I mean, there's not much novel.
It's only history, no novels. So.
Yeah.
No Harry Potter.
So it's like it's really time consuming if you try to find what is the forum, the actual forum of new ideas. Time to time the good thing is that in America and England they publish like for students, history students or any kind of students the textbook. And in those textbooks there are good summaries of the events.
Well, who's doing the textbook?
These are normal, not up. So the thing is, there are really excellent historians, but they publish like new ideas, but they don't publish syntheses. But there are these normal college professors who make time to time their synthesis, and those are good too. You have to find which one is good. Yeah. See, there's not one name, and there's not one university, it only just appears.
Each one's fighting.
Yeah. And they have to publish a book every 3 years.
Publish.
That's the American system now. Sabbatical. So if they don't publish one, they are kicked out. So that's why they to be able to publish, they have to read. They must read for 3 years. So that's why they don't have any time to make any research in the archives or whatever. So that's why they keep publishing each other. So this is the system now. So there are so many books.
Sounds good.
So, if you don't mind, I would like to ask some details about the details in the Brahma and the Krishna Samhita. What I found that Bhaktivinoda Thakur finally establishes a chronology, and he puts the Indian the Indian history into 8 periods. And and after that, he tells the story of Indian philosophy, Indian scripts, I mean Vedic knowledge according to these periods, and that's very interesting. But I mean, my main question is, you know, if the duration of rule in years, we can see that for the Prajapatis or for the Manus, there are only 50 years, or the demigods for only 100 years. So how should you understand these years? I mean, the definition of year, what is it for him?
You have to see. Prajapatis are always there. Because they're established at the beginning of the universe, so they're always there. You know, when you have Gotra, you never heard of Gotra? Someone has Gotra? Gotra technically means which Prajapati your family comes from. You know, so there's 21 Prajapati, so there's 21 Gotras. So that's pretty far. But there are people today that can say their family is descended from which particular, you know, from Gautama or Atri or, you know, like this, Kardama, like that. That's pretty far. Mm.
So how should we understand that they...
Well, manas are there for 72 yuga cycles. So what that... You have to just check and see if there's any of the time frames that are given in the Vedic time and see if that comes into anything. You know, it could be the 50 also of many, maybe 50 of 50 of Brahma's life is half over. So who knows exactly what his 50 is he's putting in. You know, or it could be Prajapatis means that you have to look back and see in the Bhagavatam. I would compare this to the Bhagavatam and see who is ruling there and where they came from. You know? Bratya. It's interesting. Bratya means actually fallen.
Bratya.
Right? Isn't it? Bratya means someone who is of a higher caste who doesn't fall.
Bratya. But
here you're getting 400 AD up to here, and but you have from 12 to 17, but you only have 55 here. Shouldn't it be 550? Because the Mughals were here for 1100 years.
Yes,
500. Probably the Negroes.
Yeah, because there's
something that, yeah, number.
I would look at it from see what the Bhagavatam is saying, because the Bhagavatam gives a chronology. The Bhagavatam chronology is funny, as that's what's used by the Indian government in the curriculum. History. Bhagavatam Kali Yuga chronology. But compare it to the Bhagavatam and see what the Bhagavatam's saying and who's there, because there may be some connection back to these personalities.
But what is, can be confusing for a student and for myself as well, that year, so the, what we mean by 1 year in the Prajapatis, for example, is it the same unit as 1 year in the British rule?
That may not be. You know, the point is that you have a history where they're actually paying attention. You know, probably from maybe these outcasts and all that, right? Because that's down here, but the Prajapatis, Manus, Demigods, and Vaivasvata, those are dealing on another level. So So who knows exactly what they're dealing with there? You know, what time he's dealing with. But, you know, it's okay if he puts it into here because he'll keep people quiet. You know?
But Kemble, he always refers to the Bhagavatam. I mean,
so therefore I compare it to the Bhagavatam and see what it is. Because Bhagavatam tells exactly how many years a particular group of people are going to rule. And just get that and then compare it against this. And then see what's going on. See if we can make some connection. You could also ask Sariputta if they've done anything like that.
But is it, then generally could we claim that these units are referred to those who ruled during that period? So?
It may be. Mm. It may be that these are Prajapati units, the Manu units, demigods, because Prajapati units are pretty big. As far as they go, they're always there, so Brahma's life is half over. So that means it's only been 50 years for them. Mm. You know, the Manus, their life is half is one quarter or one 14th of a day of Brahma. You know, so that means 72 yuga cycles is their life. So then half of that would be Manus then. Mm. You know, the demigods, then they're on a shorter time than the Prajapatis. Oh no, it depends. Some of the demigods, they rule the same. Indra and that. They, as long as the Manu is in the seat, they're in the seat. As soon as Manu goes, they all change. When Manu changes, Indra, you know, Varuna, Agni, they all change. It's a different, same seat, but a different soul. So then you could see what's there. So it could go like that. But since you're doing it in that, then they just put it into here because in those days, then the BC thing, you know, they don't want to go. That, I mean, still, that's quite a long way back. That's 6,000 years ago, 6,500 years ago. So even that's quite, you know, pushing it. Nowadays, I think they're accepting that it goes back a little bit more. But otherwise, they'd like to just put a 5,000-year limit from today. So that's 3,000 BC. So here, this is already 1,500 years back.
So, but for the sorry for insisting on this, but if you put the dynasties next to each other in a Western chronology, when it finishes, then comes the next one. But here we don't have to think that when the Manus came to rule, and the Prajapatis were over. These are they can be parallel.
They can be parallel also. Because when the Prajapatis are there, the Manus and demigods and Vaisvata will be parallel, because Prajapatis are always there. You know, like that. Because
now I understand that.
They're in Brahma's group. You know, they're either his children or his grandchildren. So they live as long as the universe. They live as long as Brahma does. You know. So I'm just saying, as Prajapatis, their life, we're in the 51st year now. Like that. You know, Brahma's 51 years old now. Or I'm not sure, I think the 51st year is running. So he's 50, you know, coming up to that. So of that, we're in the 7th Manvantara, which means half of the first day, and in the 28th cycle of the Kali Yuga. I mean, of the yugas. There's 1,000 cycles, so we're in the 28th. So that's right. So we're in the 50. Like that. I mean, 1 year is a long time. You know, a long time.
And that's an excellent example, because the concept of hierarchy is different in the West than in the Vedic point of view. Mm-hmm. So I understood some things better.
Yeah, in other words, I said, you just say it's like this, and the people just look great and just move on, because you're not worried about this, because they already have their ideas about this.
Yeah, but the thing is, they would claim, I mean, that if you just show it like that, I'm afraid that students would say that this is nonsense. So you have them.
The point is we're talking a preaching technique. Bhaktivinoda Thakur mentions in the beginning of the book. all the books are written either for the Uttamas or the Kanistas. And generally the book is not written for the Madhyamas. Means, written for the Madhyamas means in their service, how would they preach knowing what they know through the you know, because the Madhyama, the one element is there is the metaphysical. They can comfortably accommodate the metaphysical. So then, well, the neophyte tends to not to, and the Uttama doesn't bother with it. You know, just like that. So to be able to deal with that metaphysical, that, you know, and so many things are just going on all at once, all these subtleties. So it's just a method of preaching. So when you're teaching this Krishna Samhita, this is not like, this is the history book. This is a method of teaching, you know, a way of preaching through the medium of history. And I just compare it to the Bhagavatam and see kind of what's going on. There's also I forget what book it is, what it's called. I don't remember, but we have one that's very nice. It's done by one Indian gentleman. Where he goes through and establishes actual dates of things, you know, according to the Vedic perspective, not the modern academic. And he gives all kinds of interesting references and stuff like that. He gives letters, you know, actual letters between Max Mueller and, you know, the British, whoever it was that was hiring him. What was his purpose in translating the books, what he was supposed to do. You know, it's basically to destroy the culture and all, you know, stuff like that. I don't know what the name of the book is. Wait till I get back to the finding. But that gives also a timeline. No, Buddha, you know, Shankara, and all these different things, because those are a lot of mahazes for people. Nimbarka is a date for Nimbarka.
May I send an email? A little back, just for...
Yeah. Just mention this. What is that history book by the Indian Walla who gives
the actual timeline?
So I think we're basing ours kind of along that.
I'd like to ask some detailed questions about his argument. First, I'd like to quote him. He says that generally there are five types of paramarthic dharmas or spiritual duties that have been known by different names in different countries at different times. So this is where he's comparing India with outside countries. The religious principles taught by Muhammad and Jesus are similar to the religious principles taught by the Vaishnav sect. Buddhism and Jainism are similar to Saiva Dharma. And this is in his system. He says these five dharmas from Shakta Dharma up to Vaishnava Dharma. So how could we understand that more? These parallels that he makes.
Yes,
so it's my abbreviations I made.
So Yaganapatya, Shaiva, and Vaishnava. Yeah, this is Brahma Samhita.
Yeah.
The five, the Panchopasana.
Yeah.
Okay. The problem, because the Muhammad and Jesus, he's taking the element of that there's one God, there's a supreme God, monotheist. Shaiva Dharma, in that they're going for Shaiva Buddhism, Jainism, they're going for they're dealing on that somehow or another the consciousness is different from matter. The one maintains it, but the other one, I'm not sure if Jainism maintains it, Buddhism annihilates it. You know, it just, you know, extinguishes it. But Shaiva is, because the Shaiva Dharma, it means that Shakta is matter, that's your scientist, and that he may have something else, I don't, you know, because of that notion. But that, the Surya, he, that Surya is your, all these, you have Ganapatya and Surya. Oh no, he's done Ganapatya, so. So Surya means his life, you know, in other words, all the plants and everything that's based on the sun, it lives because of the sun. Ganapatya will be a group, a particular group of persons. So that would mean, you know, that you're worried about this group of life, you know, Hungarian or, you know, natural living in the forest and the animals, your eco, you know, greenie, or you're worried, huh?
Race,
you know, like that. Anything where you're dealing with a group. The Gana is a group. But here he's taken it into these things, which is really nice. He's got down the essence. So therefore the key is this matter, heat, consciousness, pure consciousness, supreme consciousness. That's the fear. So they're conscious, Shaiva Dharma, but they're not supreme, they don't know God, so they're impersonalists. So then he brings that up, is that there is a similarity, but other than that, there probably isn't. So that way then you could, in other words, like you see Prabhupada, he would just take the supreme conscious aspect out of the Muhammad and the Christian, the Islam and Judaism, and the Christian, just developing love for God, that they'll all agree to. Beyond that point, there's no connection. They won't, there's, you know. So but if you stick on that point, then you have something common. So that would be the thing. We're trying to get the Buddhists, the Jain, all they're trying to get the pure consciousness. So any impersonal school or that then would agree with that. Ganapati is just conscious of others. So you're careful for others, nice with others, good with others, do good for others. Like that. Surya is just, you know, nature. You know, the sun is there, everything grows, there's a natural unity in nature and everything. And Shakti is just matter, it's just dead matter, what's the commonality, what's the interaction. You know, there's scientists are all that. You know.
And once you also said that Jainism was established by Rishabhadev. It's not in Krishna Samhita or somewhere else.
That it is. It's not established by Rishabhadev. The Rishabhadev was practicing it. And then whatever his name was, the original Jain dude?
Mahavir.
Mahavir, yeah. But there's one who's way back and then one who's more recent. So whatever it is, somebody saw him performing those austerities, and he developed his own concept from that and started this religion. So in that way, then Rishabhadev is the start. He was performing what's called Jara Yoga, what means that you just completely ignore the material energy, you know, like that. But you're connected with the supreme. Agora is the same kind of, a similar kind of thing, but they connect it to Lord Shiva. You know, and these guys, your Jains, then they connect it to, I guess, I don't know, nothing. You know, like that. But there is an Adijina. There's Adi Buddha, there's an Adijina, which is Krishna. So the concept, in other words, Krishna introduces all these different things, because otherwise, where would people get them from? Mm. Right. So it's just standard that these are the ways that people can think in the universe and keep themselves busy. So every creation is the same. Mm. There's always these same philosophies. Oh, it's believed it came from the northwest. So they're bringing it from the northwest. We're taking it. Modern history takes it northwest, meaning Central Asia. Right? But we know, according to Manu, northwest means the area around the Saraswati River. That's where, Manu mentions that, is that Brahmavarta, I think. That's Brahmavarta, that's the topmost place. Then, from there over to, I forget, maybe that, or he gives names for it. This area right around the Saraswati River, that's the top, because that's where all the Saraswati Brahmas are from. Then there's an area bigger than that that kind of reaches down to like Delhi and all that. Then that's the next area. Then there's another one that reaches then farther down, it goes like down to Varanasi and all that, and leaves Bengal and Bihar and all those places. Then the biggest is then from the, the Arabic, not Arabic, the ocean on that side of India.
Indian Sea. Arabic Sea.
Yeah, the Arabic Ocean over to means north, I mean south of the Himalayas, north of the Vindhya Mountains, from the Arabic Sea down to the Bay of Bengal. Yeah. That kind of like swath there. Yeah. That is, I think, Aryabharta. Mm. Like that. It's there in Manu. She can tell you. It's right in the beginning of the second chapter.
Yeah. He refers it to Manu.
Yeah. So there, then, so when he says, so he just says northwest. So then in their mind, northwest will be Central Asia. Or Europe. At his time, it probably would have been more Europe. Now they say Central Asia, you know, the proto-Aryan. You know, like that. I didn't mean to make a cough. So, proto-Aryan. She's the linguistic. Right? So, but we know it means it's coming from there. You know, it's just like, you know, it's just like, you know, I say, like you're talking to some politician, and over that way is the Parliament House. But we're talking Parliament politics, meaning that house right there. You know, so we say, you know, over there's so much politics. We are talking there, but the person you're talking to thinks, yeah. You know. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah. But isn't it the Aryan invasion theory what he supports here? That the Aryans came from northwest to India?
No, but that was India.
No. But the northwest was India as well.
Northwest means is Pakistan. No. It means basically what was under the rule of the kings that were worth talking about was up to Gundar, which means Afghanistan. So Afghanistan over to Burma, you know, and from the Himalayas down to the oceans. That was what would at that time been India. And that's basically Bharatvarsha. That means in more modern, that's where kind of like Varnashram's practice. Outside of that is basically tribal. Even South India, south of India is tribal. So his meaning is those, they stayed up there, but then at one point when the Saraswati River dried up, then they invaded. And they went across down to, because he mentions Aryabharta, they went down to Bengal. Like that, though one group then went from there, went down south to like Madhya Pradesh, Karnataka, that area over there, the Konkan area. So those are the Saraswat Brahmins. But the other ones went down and came through and came to Bengal. And then from Bengal, then from there they went down south. So that's why they're Gore Saraswat Brahmins, because they went to Bengal first. So in that way you could say there was an invasion, because then they started going south and going west, because the Saraswati River used to go into the ocean. Like that. That's the way it originally was. But in the Rig Veda, it's mentioning about how it goes, it's going the opposite way, it's going inland. And it just disappears into the sand. You know, and by then at some point, then it just disappeared altogether. So then that whole, you know, civilization, they just packed up and moved, you know, because it became a desert. So then they, you know, diaspora. Yeah, then they just left. So you could call that the invasion, but it's not that they came in with their, you know, knives and swords and butter knives and, you know, like that and took over. Just they were the Brahmins and that's the culture, so, you know, everybody would be happy to have the Saraswat Brahmins. They're famous. So then they just came in and settled other places. But to the modern historian, it would sound like they came and took over and established their culture, but they are the Brahmins, so therefore then they would naturally establish their culture, but it was, the culture was already going on. You know what I'm saying?
But he also states that there was a conflict between the invaders or the Aryas, so not invaders, Aryas he says, and the inhabitants, I mean the aboriginals.
Yeah,
and
because there would be, naturally.
And he says there's the conflict between Daksha and Lord Shiva and Rudra. So he says that Rudra was the king of the inhabitants.
Because South India is his place.
Yeah.
So many
no, that's actually in the north, that's in Brahmavarta.
Oh, okay.
And the whole, the sacrifice of Daksha and...
Could be. So in other words, it must have been that those Saraswat Brahmins were Vaishnavas. And then all the others were Shaivites. So when they left and they came down and were establishing Vaishnavas. Because you have that whole fight between them. That whole principle is there. Because that principle is always there. Everything will be functioning on the same thing. So that fight there is just obvious. But otherwise the fight between the Vaishnavas and the Shaivites is always going on.
But here I have personally the time problem again. That all this happened, so the movement from the northwest to the, that happened like when the Saraswati River dried out, so it like, I don't know, 3,000 years ago. But the conflict between Rudra and Daksha that happened in Yuga.
Yeah, but the point is that is the prototype of it. So whenever Vaishnavas and Shaivites meet, you have the same problem. You know, it's just like you have a big party meeting, you know, in the square, you know, like this, amongst, you know, for one political party, and then another political party is there, and it starts a riot. Now, out here in the village, you're one political party, your neighbor is the other political party. But based on that whole same thing, then, you know, you're over there doing something, and then something happens, and then, you know, can't you keep your, you know, branches of your tree off my land? Oh, you listen, and it starts to, it's the same thing. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So you can say it's just, it's that. In other words, it's just a reflection, expansion of the same thing. Otherwise, they've been fighting since that time.
Can I have a question relating to this? You mentioned that on the north, the Saraswata Brahmanas, they were Vaishnavas. They came in.
I'm just saying it could be that that's what's...
Because what I heard about those cultures, if they accept anything Vedic, then they say more it was some kind of Shaiva culture. Like they had lingas in the archaeological records.
But Vaishnavas also worship lingas. It's not a problem.
Okay.
That's not a problem. Because there's also deities of Vishnu, but they kind of ignore those.
Mm-hmm.
Because basically speaking, all your Indologists in the West are Shaivites. They're all impersonalists. You know, have you met a Vaishnav Indologist?
No.
Naturally, they're going to, you know, suppress those things. You know, it's just like every couple of years, at least it comes out in the papers in India, they find some four-armed Vishnu deity in some far-out country. They found some years ago when one in Russia. You know, in some dig somewhere, they found one in South America. You know, you don't hear about it so much in the rest of the world, but, you know, because India is, you know, it's one of our boys, you know, like, you know, so, you know, so you get it, you know, like that. So then, yeah, but you don't hear about that, because when I mention it outside India, no one's ever heard of it. So, but why? You know, because it becomes it just is not considered important. You know, it's like, you know, the modern man's matter man's skull found by Leakey, you know, next to the Neanderthal, and then, you know, he doesn't accept. You know, it'd be, oh, they were digging up a grave of the Neanderthal, and then modern man, he tripped and fell in and broke his neck, so that's why
he's in there. He left his skull there.
Yeah, you know, something like that, you know. Whatever. Yeah. Is that okay?
Yeah.
In other words, he's showing, because if we're going by the swan aspect, it's the essence of it. What is the fight between Daksha and Prajapati? You know, he's doing it in the inverse to show that he's trying to give credit to the Bhagavatam and the Bhagavatam that all these things are true. And he's just putting it into context of the modern history. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So in other words, he's showing how this is that. But he doesn't specifically say that actually the Daksha Yogi is first and then this is coming afterwards. He's just saying this is that. In other words, this is that principle. Mm-hmm. So the Swan Lake man understands it's the principle. And then these historians will take it that it's the fact, it's the chronology. It's just a matter of you say it and leave it. That's how Buddha, it means, it's Buddha is, it's, you can say is that this style of preaching, you could say, comes from Buddha. Mm. Like the lecture of the rose. Right? You know that one? I don't know, it's very famous lecture, it's probably one of his most famous lectures, you know, huge crowd, thousands of people, and he sat there, and then when there was, you know, and everybody, and then when he sat, and everyone was ready for him to talk, then, you know, a hush came over the crowd, he just held up a rose, didn't say anything, just held up the rose, and then everybody's speculating on, oh, he means this, or soft by the rose, or this, or opening like the flower, the consciousness, you know, everybody just made up their own idea. You know, so that's what the Buddhism does, is you just throw out something and then let them play with it. Shankara does the same thing. He takes a few verses from the Vedanta Sutra, you know, from Gita, where you could juggle the words and then give some other interpretation. Then he says, like this you go on interpreting. He does not interpret the whole Vedanta Sutra. He doesn't do that. Vaishnavas give a commentary on each verse, but he only gives on selected verses. So it's a natural technique used by God and the devotees to preach. In other words, you say something that's enough to connect it for them, but not more, so they'll speculate on their own and come up with their own understanding. Which is what we want, because we're not worried about these, we're just trying to get past. So it's not that he would sit down and give us whole chronological things. He would start speaking, and if somebody brought it up, this is what you'd say. You know what I'm saying? In other words, you would be trying to preach Bhagavatam, but when you ran into these academic doubts, then this is what you would say, and then it would be written off and just continue. But because he's putting it all in one place, therefore it looks like it's a treatise on that. You know what I'm saying? That's how you present it. It's just like Manu, that's not how you present it to the modern person. Because it gives every possible aspect that's there. You know, it's just like marriage. There's eight kinds of marriage. Because there's eight ways that a man and a woman could come together. There's not a ninth. Right, there's eight ways. Of those, two of them are just rejected as just being bogus. They can, it means, in other words, it is possible to do, but culturally it would be rejected. So that's down to six. Right? Then of that, then in Kali Yuga, two of them are rejected. Mm-hmm. So that leaves you four. And of the four, are the best ones, the first one. Like that. So, in other words, he's recommending the first one. But if it can't be, then you have the other ones. Does that make some sense? So, they're always... It's not something you wouldn't teach that to the common person. But you just show what's proper and all that like that. Or the laws. The laws is generally where devotees, if they leave it, they free. Because you see every possible, so it looks like it's very, very harsh. And no, but it's like maybe, who knows, once in your lifetime a king might have to apply one of those rules. But if that occasion comes up, he has to know what to do. And so it goes in that section. You know, generally he'll be dealing with common thieves or this, he won't be dealing with, you know, other things. But if it does come up, someone does break a dam, or someone does, you know, go and disturb it, then he knows what to say. But those things are rare. You know, it's just like breaking dams, bothering with the treasury, bothering with certain other things. It's just capital punishment. But how often do you get somebody stupid enough to try to break into the national treasury? Right? It happens.
Things are already there.
Yeah, it happens, but it's very rare. But if breaking into the local shop, that's always happening. But the two rules are right next to each other, so it appears to the person that doesn't understand, I mean to the common person, that, you know, just so heavy on all these different things. But no, this is any possible thing could way the law could be broken, it's all put there. So in the same way as any possible way that he has, you know, he is giving, that the academics might be disturbed by the Bhagavatam's historical presentation, he gives, you know, how they get around it. Though you wouldn't go in and necessarily give a whole presentation like that. You know, in other words, you're trying to present the swan-like aspect. But if you can't get through that, then you start with the ass-like and move into the swan-like. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, my other general question would be what should be considered as symbolic for his argument and what is real? For example, when he talks about when Rahu was cut into two and by his neck, he says that's when science of astrology was being discussed at that time.
When?
When the head of Rahu was cut off.
And when? Which was being discussed?
He says that, I quote, "We can understand from this, when Rahu was cut into two, that the science of astrology was being discussed at that time." Later he adds, "There was no any written language during this time, so astrology was expressed only by symbols." So by Rahu, is it another method, what you just mentioned, how to push it through?
Yeah.
You can understand
everything in that book is that. You know, it's not that he's saying symbolic or this or that, because you have to be very careful with this, because otherwise it's dangerous. We have our own devotees, very intelligent, who've been distracted by stuff like this, and they'll say everything's just analogies, it's not this and that. We're completely bogus. Because they're attached to the academic way of thinking. You know, our point is we're not attached to it, but since we have to deal with it, these are methods to deal with it. But if you actually believe in it, then it becomes, you take on the ass-like mentality. Baba used to call Prajumna an ass because he carried around so many books. You know, like that. So they just have so much knowledge, so big, but, you know, not really going deep. Like you say, they just read other book and then produce a new journal. Mm-hmm. They're not really going in and understanding. So in that, it would be discussed, because the point is astrology would be discussed. Okay, who was sitting there? Sun, Moon, and Rahu. Right? So there's a discussion between the planets. So, in other words, if it means astrology, or astronomy, whichever word you use, is the subject matter on the planets. So if the planets themselves are talking, whatever they're talking, it's astrology. You know, and they were, and okay, here, let's take it even a step further. If we're taking astronomy as the position of the planets. The actual purpose of astronomy is to be able to calculate where the planets are at any given point. Like, I want to know what right now, what are the planets? And I can say exactly by mathematics that this one's, you know, in the Lagna, this one's here, this is in each zodiac sign, which planets are where, you know, down to the second. Like that. So, Sun and Moon are there and going, Rahu's here. So, that's astronomy. Does that make sense? So, that's what I'm saying. It's not in any way contradictory. It's just one has to give credit to how clever Bhaktivinoda Thakura is. That he could take it to the point, bring it out like that. That's Acharya.
He never pronounces the word symbolic. It was my mind. Who
that's the point.
Looking for a
that's the point is that yeah. That's what the academic will think. You just presented, it was a discussion. I says, what is that? It's a discussion on astronomy or astrology, whichever, you know, we use. Because it was a discussion on astronomy. Because astronomy means where's the planet's place? And they pointed out, Rahu's sitting here. He's supposed to be over there. You know? So then you just take it, oh, okay. Because as soon as you say that, then it's, oh. And then everybody drops it. You know, there's no further discussion. Because that's what you want to do. You just want to shut down ass-like discussions. And get into swan life. Because that's like useless. You go on all day, waste your time all day, and stuff like that. You just want to get to the essence. So if you simply say, oh, that was an astronomical discussion, you know, which it was, you know, so, you know what I'm saying? But you just say that as a discussion on that, you know. Then it just goes off. You know? Does that make sense? These are very, very clever things on how he could. Would be able to see that that's actually the essence of what's going on. Because otherwise you just take a story of like that, but they were pointing out that Rahu's in the wrong place. You know, according to the, you know, the way the normal, natural movement of the planets, he's supposed to be over there. Then Rahu's the head and Ketu is his body. You know, that happened, but he doesn't get into it there because they're not astrologers, so they won't.
He says, he puts it very nicely. I didn't copy it down, but he says, first he just talks about Rahu, and then Rahu and Ketu. So it doesn't mention that they're having body, but it's there. It's a similar area, I suppose, that when he talks about the ascendants of Kashyapa who accepted features of snakes and birds. And those snakes, the Nagas, were later found in the present-day territory of Pakistan in the kingdom. So how could we explain that snakes have a kingdom? Which is discussed.
Well, I'm just saying, what did Bhakti Noka
say? He doesn't develop that idea. He just says that...
He just says they became the snakes and Nagas. So it just says that they later became... Because the point is they're born from him, and they have human forms, and they have their animal forms. Mm. Nagas can take both forms. Mm. Like Ulupi, she was a Naga, but for Arjuna, she took a human form. Or when Bhima went there, they all took human forms.
But Western scholars would think of Naga as present in Nagaland, and those, so they would say, isn't it just a reference that those tribes or those humans had a...
Maybe.
Yeah. They use the symbol. The
point is they're there, and you know, you have something, you found them there, and if they're living over here now, you know, hey, people move, you know. You know, it says, you know, you live in the place where you were born, you know, it's kind of like, it was a thing.
We don't enter into that discussion.
No need to, because that becomes that's the ass-like that he's talking about. In other words, you want to try to avoid the ass-like and keep it into the swan-like. Because the swan is you're trying to, you know, means in other words, you can use the modern technique to, or postmodern technique, to advantage is that, is the chronology what's important, or is what's going on important? So he's just saying that these are connected. What happened in this and that, you know, you can't even remember what you did yesterday, you know, so then, you know, so why are you worried about it? So you can use that as also a way to distract from these topics. You know, it means if you're a post-instructor, Or you could say, well, that's a very modern viewpoint on it. You know, that will insult the intelligence or the dignity of the postmodern, you know, academic, you know. Like that, and immediately he'll just drop it because it's like, even though he'd love to pursue it, he won't because that would be modern, you know, he's postmodern. So. Mm. Yeah, you know, like that. And tell all his friends, you know. It's amazing, in this universe, you know, there's a postmodern. I said, I'll just have to tell my friends. And no, it's okay.
How to harass. The other question is about Parashuram. That he says that there were several Parashurams, at least two. One who destroyed the Kshatriyas, but after that he created a new class of Brahmins and Kshatriyas. And he says, I quote, Parashuram again fought with the Kshatriyas out of greed to capture their kingdom. And that kingdom is Brahmavarta. So how should we conceive that Parashuram fought out of greed?
I guess to just get things for the Brahmins, or out of greed means that the kings themselves are greedy, so on the principle of greed, the fight was happening. You know?
So it doesn't refer to him.
Not necessarily. It could be greed meaning that we would take greed meaning when to get something. More so here, because he gave the whole planet to the Brahmins, so he wanted to give it to the Brahmins. That could be, or it could be because the kings were greedy, therefore that was the basis of the fight.
So that's language.
Yeah, so in other words, you just use something clever to reverse it. Because you know, because you have to be careful, is if you say that and you just say it, then it may be offensive. So if you know what it is, then you know what it's saying. You know, just like the Acharya Sishupala saying things about Krishna. You know, you don't have any caste, no one can tell who you are, this and that. And the Acharyas are writing and saying, yes, he's above an ashram, he's above, you know, beyond, you know, intelligence and knowledge. You know, like that. So there's all glorification. So you have to, you know, what is the glorification? Like that. And so that's what you're thinking. And everybody else would just think, okay, yeah, okay. He created a new class of kings. I'm not sure of that, but after it's mentioned in Mahabharata that after everybody was killed, then there were no kings left. I'm not sure what this means. Then it could be that he would kill the kings, but then his sons were there, and then he'd come back, kill them, and their sons were there. But what he get after 21 generations, there were no more kings left. But the queens were there. So the queens approached the Brahmins, and the Brahmins then begot children. And so then those kings were basically like Brahmins. So then it was like Satyuga during that time, even though it was Kriyuga. So that's described in Mahabharata, right in the beginning chapters. So then, you know, it could be it's like this. If I go and kill the king, that in itself creates a new generation of kings. But here it makes it sound like he killed the kings, made someone else a king, then out of greed fought with them. But here he's killed the kings, that precipitates that a new king has to be established. So it's because of him, then there is a new king. Then that new king then, you know, is greedy, and then he comes in. So Parashurama comes and kills him also.
And the next question refers to Parashurama as well, but it's a general question that we always, when we argue with Indologists, you know, they normally say that these our scripts were put together by different authors. Why we say that? No, this is the absolute that we ask. We always keep insisting on that only one author. But here, Bhaktivinoda Thakur says that, for example, the Manu Samhita was put together or elaborated by another Parashuram 600 years after Kurukshetra. Or he says that Valmiki wrote the Ramayana, but after that another author elaborated it. And he also says that Vyasadeva, it was Vedavyas who put down the the outline of Mahabharata, but there was another Vyas who elaborated the Mahabharata. So how should we
What was the first one? Let's start with the last one. Vyasa wrote it down. In other words, the outline was 600,000 verses. That's what he taught. Then Vaishampayana, who was a student, would be another Vyasa, because whoever sits on the Vyasasana is basically representing Vyasa. He spoke in 100,000 verses. That's the one we have. But what he does, if you just say that, then it stops. What he doesn't go on to say is, then Vyasadeva wrote that one down. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
In other words, he taught Bharat to his students, but the Bharat, as it was spoken by Vaishampayana, right, to Janamejaya, that's the version, and then was then spoken by Suta Goswami to the sages at Naimisharanya after hearing that elaboration. That was written. You know what I'm saying? So then Suta is also another Vyas. So like that. That's
the other one is Valmiki's Ramayana.
Because Valmiki wrote the Ramayana, and then after that his students wrote the Uttara Ramayana, Ananda Ramayana, this Ramayana, that Ramayana. He doesn't mention it's a different book. Ramayana ends with the coronation of Ram, that's where it ends. So after that, what happens after with Laban Kush, that's the Uttara Ramayana.
So that's a different book, a different
work. It's a different work.
That's a different work.
It's always put together, but it's put, so it may be he wrote the Ramayana or taught it. His disciples may have compiled it, putting that in the beginning because they tell it from Laban Kush telling this story, like that. But they put in the Laban Kush part.
He also says that Valmiki was an Aryan who loved to tease the southern persons. That's why he
teased
the southern, the Dravids, the inhabitants of
Valmiki.
Yeah. So that's why he puts tails on those persons and hair all over the body. So he says that the monkey and the bear form is just teasing the Dravids. So he pronounces the word tease. So that was part, because he was Aryan from the north, but he just wanted to tease the southern. That's why he showed them, or he presented them with tail, like monkeys or bear-like creatures.
Yeah, they could. Because they have other forms. They could take any form, but that's they're vanaras. So that's the form. So they're actually human forms. But you know, you could say there's no need to bring that out. But you could say there's no need to bring it out, but at the same time as they are Varnas, so they are in that form. But they are humans. So you could say is from that, because modern scholars they don't know what Varnas, they've never heard of Varnas. So they wouldn't consider them as humans. So they're in the 400,000 species of human life. So then they would be, you could say, you know, just he brought that out or something, you know, to make it more fun or something. I don't know.
Yeah, but later the problem was that even southern Indian scholars said that Ravana was the representative. So the whole Ramayana tells the story how the Aryas were pushing the dark-skinned southern drivers toward the south, and Rama represents the Aryans. So there was this kind of discussion in the 19th century.
Oh, but that's their interpretation, because the Tamils, it'll be done by the Tamil scholars, not by other scholars. Because the Tamils, they have an idea that their culture is supreme.
But that's nationalist.
Yeah, it's just nationalist, because it's not specifically Dravidian as a whole, it's Tamils as specific. It means they couldn't care less about the other three southern states, the Kannadas and the Andrans and the Malayans, like that. They have nothing good to say about them either.
And also he says that it's proved that the Srimad Bhagavatam was written in the south part of India, because in the 11th, he quotes a verse from the 11th canto when Veda Vyas says that the southern Indian somehow they didn't quote it down. But they are better in something. And that's why he says that Veda Vyas was inclined towards the southern part of India. So this is a proof for him that it was written in the southern.
It could be. It means that parts of it was written all over, just like the 10th canto was written sitting in the garden. Is that one place on the Parikrama path? Mm. It has the plot where the 10th canto was written. Mm. You know? So it could be he sat all over India when he compiled it. You know, so even if you, if one of the places you sat was south, and you say this proves it was written in south, means it would infer it means the whole thing, but it's not necessarily it's the whole thing. Mm. You know, so if they're inclined towards it's in south or something, then why not? Mm. So in other words, the whole idea is to get past the ash-like comments and mentality, and get to the essence. That's the whole idea that we're trying to do. Just trying to get right past it. By getting past it, then people, they said, will listen to what you have to say. Right? Because he's not trying to say this. You know, it's like what's later in the chapter where he brings it around to, if he brings up the transcendental and that's what he's trying to say. But in saying, in other words, probably he's broken up the chapters, is that he wants to say this point, you know, the philosophical points, the swan-like points. But in making those swan-like points, historians may come up with these doubts, so that he covers all those doubts in the beginning and shows how to get to that swan-like point. You know? So depending on the audience, if you're just preaching, you're starting with swan-like points, and then someone raises their hands and say, well, what about this? Then you have an answer. Or if you know you're going into a group of historians or that kind of academics, then you go in and then you just start covering these points and then bring it out into there. So it's just these are ways you can use it. I think he even mentions, I'm not sure if it's in this book, Krishna Samhita, he mentions read the first part, read the last part, then read the middle. I'm not sure it's not in this book. I'm not sure. You have to look. But one of his books, he says, it's in three parts. You should actually read the first part, then the third part, then the second. But as far as logical presentation, it would go 1, 2, 3. But as far as the mind works, it's 1, 3, 2. Right? Because tattva is sambandha, abhideya, prayojana. You have a relationship, you act in that relationship, you get a goal. But the mind doesn't work like that. It works sambandha, I have a relationship, there's a goal I want, therefore I work. Does that make sense? So then, like that, then after that, then you've read the three, then it'll click in like this, so you can think in both ways. Because in tattva it works that way, in rasa it works the other way. In intelligence it works sambandha abhideya prayojana, and in mind it works sambandha prayojana abhideya. Does that make sense? So it's just the field is known so well, he can easily move from one definition of the same word to another definition of the same word very easily. You know? Like that. You know, you can talk about the personality of Shankarshan, or talk about the field of activities and what are the elements. Because the ones come from the other. Like that. Though somebody, it may, how do these connect? You know, so then give the logical connection. So he's just able to do that, is move in and out of these words and stuff like that. That makes sense.
Yes. It's like when he talks about when he dates the different scriptures, and he says that first it was the philosophies who were written down, and it was like an answer for the Buddhist challenge.
to Vedic culture. Then it came the Puranas. So, and they said that, for example, Srimad Bhagavatam was written in the 9th century. It was just to please the mind of the historian.
Yeah, because it could be one if there is, how do you say, who knows when it was written down, when Vyasadeva actually compiled it. But at the same time, it was there before, because Bhagavatam is always there. It is a literature that's eternal.
He says that as well.
Yeah. Yeah, the point is, it's there, but when it's written down. So as a body of knowledge, it's eternal. So when it's written, compiled, and then what way it's compiled, that's maybe the unique presentation of this time. But otherwise, it's always the same body of knowledge. The Gita is the same body. That's why it's called the 14 books of knowledge, because they're eternal books. In Brahma's court, you have all the different books personified, and they sit there and have discussions amongst themselves. So you can imagine spending, you know, so much time, you know, being that literature and discussing it with others. And so then they naturally then come to the conclusion that Krishna, you know, is God, and they develop that affection for him. So then they make their appearance as gopis, because they actually know the essence. So that would show then, that would be another proof that the essence of the Vedas is to know Krishna. Otherwise, why do the personified Vedas come as gopis in Vrindavan, you know, and not as servants in Vaikuntha? So that would show that that's the actual essence. But it's always going on. So it could be there. Or it could be in the 9th century, yes. I'm sure there was somebody who was copying the Bhagavatam from another Bhagavatam and making a copy for themselves. I'm sure it was going on. You know? So then, like another way it was written. You don't have to say who wrote it.
You don't have to say this was the first version.
Yeah, you don't have to say it's the original manuscript or that. You just say it was a copy. You know?
And at the end, he turns to the mantras and he says that the Maha Mantra is for Kali Yuga. And he says that the soul-like people of foreign countries should accept these holy names in their own language. So what does this mean, in their own language? And he adds, there shouldn't be any complex scientific consideration, useless arguments, or any kind of direct or indirect prayer. So their own language means that they should just put the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra as it is into their language.
That's how I would take it.
Yeah.
They should, you know, put it into their language. Means, you know, we would, how you say, the interpretation we'd make is we would translate it into their language. Mm-hmm. But put it into the language means just put it. Like we say, put this on the table, means just put on the table.
Mm-hmm. It says we should accept. Yeah. So the word should accept these holy names in their language.
Only. Yeah. So in their language means it should just go, in their language they should accept them. Mm-hmm. You know, but also the meanings of it they can accept in their language. You know, just like, the my Lord, you know, please engage me in your service. So that's accepting the holy name in their language. But it's still chanting as Hare Krishna. Because you always have to see, there's also a point of logic, there's this point made first and what's made later, that is more specific. Identifies the first one. Like if a general statement's made at the beginning and then something more detailed is made later, then that would make it more specific, you know, for the thing. So then you would understand exactly what he's meaning. Does that make sense? Like that is, it's one of the forms of logic. It's an element of logic.
I think I have some few other questions, but I don't want to monopolize the time, so, you know, I don't know how...
Well, no, this is specifically your time. Yeah. And then she had something. We do just discuss that, and then if there's that, go back to yours.
I have two questions.
One is related to the civilization that who are the inhabitants of South America. So how they are connected to Vedic culture, and then I will move to the.
Okay. From what I understand, Prabhupada mentions that that's for Kumbhakarna, not Kumbhakarna. Mahiravana.
State.
And I think Kumbhakarna would go there and hang out. Then go down there and snooze or something. But there was a, Prabhupada mentions a tunnel between India and
that is the Lanka we have, like Sri Lanka is not the Lanka where Ravana lives.
No, but South America wasn't either, because Mahi Ravana was a different Ravana.
Oh.
There were three Ravana. Right, there was the 20-armed Ravana, Mahi Ravana, I'm not sure what was his thing, but he was into illusions and stuff like that. And then I think there was a 1,000-armed Ravana or something like that. So they're all around the same time. But I don't know much about the third one, but Mahi Ravana used to be kind of like, you know, friendly or something with regular Ravana. So at one point he came and stole Ram and Lakshman and took them away to his kingdom. And then Hanuman went in there and got them and all that, and they escaped as it was being destroyed. But they still have festival there in Brazil. You know, commemorating Kumbhakarna. They have a specific name for him. But one devotee was telling me that that's who it is.
I read a book about a person who brought culture to South America. His name is Vira Crocha, and there is a town near the Titicaca Lake. Where Tiahuanaco, which has still remnants, buildings, and sculptures, which are very much similar to the Vedic sculptures. And maybe that was the remnants of Kumbhakarna.
Could be. Because the Prabhupada mentions the Vedic culture was all over the world. So all of them would have been following, but it would have had its particular local, regional flavor. You know, just like north, you see how they build the temples, and south, how they build. So different according to what's important for them. You know? I mean, they're all mentioned in scriptures, just you have the gate of the temple and you have the thing, but the tendency of being north will make that bigger and the gate smaller, and the south will do the other way.
And there are huge bridge, blocks of stones, which is impossible for human beings. I mean, the present human beings to move, like the same with the pyramids and also Stonehenge. So the Stonehenge and all these things are moved by mantra.
Generally, from what I understand, is there's mantras to make the stone light, and there's mantras to make the stone soft. So they make them soft, carve them how they like. You know, make them hard again, then make them light, then move them into place, and then make them heavy again. So from what I understand, that would be how it would be done.
And the second question was that I'm doing a little research on the actual experiences of catharsis and different rasas. So I'm trying to figure out, is there any connection between the mystical or religious experience and the aesthetical or the experience in art? And what is the relationship of experiencing catharsis, which is used by the Greeks and also by the modern...
Which means?
Catharsis means purify one's heart.
Yeah.
And this is the actual experience, a rapture kind of thing. When we are experiencing aesthetical and religious experience, the actual feeling, what's inside the heart. And they said that this is the essence of art, to have that kind of feeling and to
elevate.
Uplift our soul.
Yeah. It's supposed to be. Art's supposed to be used for God consciousness. I mean, a few ways you could look at it. There's one is that that you have the different chakras, you get different kind of feelings from them. And those may be interpreted differently. Just like you get a feeling in the stomach. like when you're afraid or when there's anger, envy or attachment. It's the same feeling, but depending upon the state of the mind, you'll interpret it as a different feeling. It's actually technically for the body one feeling, but how it's interpreted, because it's created by chemicals, that will be interpreted as different. Does that make sense? So that's one thing. So that's probably why they're saying it's the same feeling. They're using that scientific thing, the same hormones are creating it or whatever. But the point is that the religious means that the proper performance of duty is there, and it creates an emotional, emotional state of experience. So then art, also because you're dealing with the mind, it would also create a similar experience. But depending upon what it is, it will either be lower or higher. You know, so art is supposed to be used for religion. It's not supposed to be used other than that. So then it should enhance the religious experience. Stuff done, in other words, religion means activities that are done in connection with God. So then here, art is a result of an activity done in connection with God. Does that make some sense? So it should give the same result. Though sometimes, yeah. And purification means if it's in connection with the Supreme, then there is an upliftment, there is a purification. But art should do that if it's a connection with God. But if it's not, it won't. It'll contaminate. Mm-hmm. Like modern art and these things are contaminated, it won't uplift.
Aristotle says that in the ancient Greek tragedies, the kathos is what that the audience experience was actually transcendental.
They can say that, but it's not. No, of course not.
Why?
Because they're just dealing with normal characters. They're not dealing with God.
Are you sure about that?
It's by the dramas that they give in Greek drama and that's dealing with, you know, just normal people. Or with great kings or with the demigods. Because the point is people will take generally central platform, you know, and the central platform of perception as normal. Then they'll take you doing something for someone else, you know, with pranamore, they'll take that as religious. And so if there was a thing where you actually understood dharma, you know, because they take religion as pranamore, not as manamore. So if there was something where you did understand anything in relationship with God, they would take that as spiritual. Because that's as far as they can get. So you could say, if you accept the impersonal experience as spiritual, in other words, the experience of Brahmananda as spiritual, then you could say it's spiritual. You could say that, but that's only transcendental for the impersonalist. Because that's
how
only...
How do you define transcendental?
Transcendental is the platform Anandamaya. Like that. Because Manamoya is Manamoya, it's the mind. So they only know the mind, so they don't actually know it's spiritual. So if there's like a pure experience in the mind where they feel uplifted and it changes their values or adjusts their values, they'll take that as a spiritual experience, if that's what this thing is, or they'll take it as a religious experience. You know, an artist will just think it's just, you know, something more nice and, you know, a better way of looking at it. And if they're religious, they'll call that a religious experience. So it's all just happening in the platform of the mind. So then, if it's gone up to the point of being freed from material entanglements and all that, not considering material elements and all that kind of things or considerations, then it would be called spiritual because you're negating the material. So you get off the, you know, you come to the Brahman platform. But that is the range of where the Brahmanandis can come to, is the Ahoksija platform. They can't get up to the Aparoksha platform. They can't get to the Ahoksija platform. You know, and definitely we can't get to that. You can't get to Aparoksha. It's not transcendental.
Don't you think that by, because the, for the old Greeks, that was a religious function, to understand that they are...
Yeah, but religion and spiritual are two different things.
They didn't use the word spiritual, they used the word transcendental.
So that's what they do, is that it's just, they may use the word transcendental, but they don't know what transcendental is.
But can we say that, you know, Brahman realization platform is transcendental, which is actually beyond the material.
It's beyond the material, but it's still on the platform of Manomaya. They haven't actually, because they don't know they're the soul. They don't know who's God. They don't really know. So basically for them, is they're taking, you have sensual experience, you have emotional experience, then you have religious, then you have what they call transcendental. So basically you have the sensual experience is there. That's obvious. The emotional experience is the mind, in that you've had some exchange with another person. If that exchange then was on the platform of duties or religious, you know, religious activities, they call it a religious experience. And if it then takes them beyond the ritual, where they forget the ritual and the relationship and that, and it takes them into another realm, they would call that transcendental. But all that except for the sensual, is being experienced on the platform of Manomaya. At best, most likely Pranamoya. You know, like that. Because for most people, religion is not actually religion, it's sub-religion. Because morality, being good, being nice, that's all sub-religion.
That means that experiencing God is not necessarily helping us to get closer to God.
Unless the art is about God. If it is, yes. But if it's not, it refines the intellect and the mind. But it doesn't necessarily bring it to transcendental.
But there are so many different aspects of God.
No. Yeah, God is also the senses. That's also God. The experience of the sense. The sense objects and all that, that is also God. Unless he sees, you don't see. Unless he hears, you don't hear. So God goes right down to the atom. So everything's God. But unless you have that consciousness, that won't be understood. I mean, you just look at it. The Greeks, the best thing they had going for them as far as philosophy was Socrates. Right? They killed him. So they can't really be transcendental. He was pointing out that there's a difference. There's a material world's illusion and this and that. They didn't like it. He was saying there's an absolute truth. We have to bring our life in contact with it. They didn't like it. They killed him. They were sophists. Just whatever the public opinion is, that's truth. So that would show that the Greeks, you know, it can't really be taken as transcendentalist. In other words, it would be an experience if it takes you beyond your body. It's so forceful and so full that you completely forget your identity, who you are and everything and about it. You're just so ecstatic, you know, or so emotionally absorbed. That they would call that transcendental. Then where it was very strong and duty and all that and stuff like that, but it was on a higher platform, if it had a higher purpose and all that, that experience would be called religious. It was between them and other members of the community or family that was that created bonding. They call that emotional. As with senses and sense objects, they call that sensual. So that's just how they define, is that it's going beyond, but for them beyond means just that it was so breathtaking you forgot who you were. They call that transcendental. Nowadays people don't know the difference, these finities, so they can't distinguish. But then, you know, you go back so many thousands of years, you know, the literature and the common person, and that would be more attuned to the fine definitions of words and feelings and experience. Like there are people nowadays who have never actually experienced any real emotional exchange with anybody, let alone religious or according to that. You know what I'm saying? They just, you know, lust, greed, anger, attachment, they never get beyond pranamoya at best.
But does it mean that experiencing transcendental feelings or emotions, that it solely depends on the
experience or artistic experience, because if we see God everywhere, whatever it could be, we can have transcendental.
Yeah. So it's
boiling down, everything depends on our
the consciousness of the individual. That's why I'm quoting these levels of consciousness. Consciousness and perception. Because God is everywhere. This is Brahman. The Brahmananda is everything's Brahman, so there's no question that anything's not. So they have no problem with Krishna's God because everything's God also. You know, the couch is God also.
Yeah, but that's for Uttamadhikaris. But for Madhyamas, you know, we need to have to relate to texts which are functioning more as Vibhavas to make up our.
Yeah, yeah. But the point is it is Krishna. So when we chant the holy name, there's a kirtan, we take the shot. It is a transcendental experience. But we may. Because of our conditioning, overlay on top of that simply the mundane aspect. You know, depending. But it is a transcendental experience. But we may not perceive it that way, or we may. It's really good kirtan, we completely forget everything, you know, all of our kind of like various attachments or inhibitions are all gone, we just dance and all that. Then, you know, we'll have felt that it was a strong, transcendental experience. You know, if it wasn't to that much, but we felt, you know, that everything was done nice and that interaction of the proper, then we'll call it religious. You know? And if we just see the drama and creates nice emotions, and we talk to another teacher, you know, or someone gives a class and brings out the emotions, we'll call it emotional, even though it still may be transcendental. You know, like Radhanath Maharaj gives a class, telling pastimes of Krishna, it brings out all these emotions. We'll just say, oh, it's very emotional. No, we'll say, oh, it's very transcendental. But it was about Krishna and that, so it was a transcendental experience. But, you know, for us, the perception was that in the emotions. You know, so that's the point, is that the emotions are the religious aspect of the transcendental. You know, we feel we just forgot everything and let go and just danced and we were crazy and we didn't care who we are, our position or anything. Then we call that transcendental.
We can do it in the discotheque.
That's my point. Therefore, I'm saying the Greeks, it's not transcendental. That's my point.
Was Socrates transcendental?
He was probably on the edge of understanding transcendence. It's probably very close, you know, but a Brahman realization, not more. He says very close, but because that's the point, that's the definition. Anything that we're creating, in other words, transcendental to them means when you forget all about your material existence due to whatever it is. They're having sex and they forget about it, right? You know, so whatever it is, so we call that transcendental. That's the point, is that it's just you forget about this. If the experience is in connection with performance of religious duties, they would call it religious. If it was in connection to exchange between persons of feelings, they'd call that emotional. And if it was exchange of senses, they call it sensual. So it's actually nothing to do with actual transcendental. It just means you transcend your position. You know, it's just like you know what I'm saying? He may be like, you know, something's going on, the religious festival is going on like that, and the music and dancing and all that, and then whoever is, let's say, the head judge of the place, who's always very stuffy somehow or another, forgets all that and just dances like everybody else. He would probably call that as transcendental experience. You know, while before that it was a religious experience, everything's going nice and everything's all the rituals and everything's very formal. In other words, when the fourth means religious would be formal, transcendental would be spontaneous. So it's the same thing, but it's just done on the smaller. So it appears within the circle here. So within that circle, that would be the transcendental aspect of the religious, emotional, like that. But actually, it's not, because the real one's out here. Does that make sense? Like that. So they may get that there, and they call it. So that's why you have different writers and poets talk about their spiritual experience going out in the forest and just communing with nature and all that. Because for them, they completely forgot about the city and their life and their problems and their position and everything and just were completely free for a moment.
That means that, as far as I understood, that there is a different definition of the word transcendence in the realm of religion and in the realm of psychology and art. For psychology and art, just transcend the mundane.
Yeah, it means transcend the in other words, transcend. You forget about your value system and your intelligence and your identity. In other words, you forget about the metaphysical platform. But it hasn't actually gotten to the spiritual. That's why we're saying it can't get beyond Manamoya. That's as high as it can get.
For the Christian, the definition of transcendence is just go beyond the physical, the material existence. So
I would say if you go back in time, you probably could get into transcendental. But now, because the church has spent the last hundreds of years saying there is no metaphysical like that, then it gets very touchy for them. So that's probably why they don't talk about it much, because if there's anything that's beyond, then, you know, according to the older tradition, you get burnt at the stake. So, you know, so they can't, you know, anyone who get too absorbed or get too, you know, forget about who they were, get burnt at the stake. So it's a bit they got problems, you know, fitting into the 21st century.
Did you read that there is a Dostoevsky Roman about in the Karma book, when Jesus shows up and sees the great inquisitor, and here I am, you were praying for me for centuries, and ultimately, you know, the great inquisitor of Spain realized that Jesus is a bothering for the Christian church, so they sent him back.
No.
Because, you know, because Jesus was showing actual symptoms of love and religion, and for the church, for the institution itself, he was, when he reappeared, he was just a battery, so they sent him back, because there was a fear that, you know, he would burn alive on the top of state.
Yeah, burn it. Yeah, it's a problem.
I hope that we wouldn't get burned.
Yeah, no, it's just a different definition. It's just like liberation. This liberation means you have a problem and get freed from it. That's liberation. So on the basic terms, it means being freed from some difficulty. But real liberation means that you're engaged in eternal service to Krishna based on love. You enter one of the transcendental planets. Because to go to the Brahman level isn't actually transcendental. It is in the realm, they're called transcendentalists because they're dealing with transcendence, but they haven't actually attained it, so they'll fall back again. So it says transcendence is eternal. It's an eternal concept. Therefore, those who are not eternal are not transcendental. Does that make sense? So you always have your bigger term of it and your smaller term of it. You know, it's just like, you know, you go to the Louvre, that's art. Right? But you go down here, you know, on your bridges and walls, and the local kids think that's art. You know what I'm saying? But those who know art will say it's not. So that's the thing, is when you have a group of persons who don't know anything other than what they have, their material experience, they only have your emotional and your sensual, because they're not even talking the intellectual here. So then, therefore, they will just define different states within that. So in other words, within the experience of the mind, they will give three states, you know, emotional, religious, and transcendental. But they're all still states of the mind. They haven't come actually to the transcendental. Right? Does that make some sense? Okay. So we have
5 more minutes.
Could we say, sorry for this term, terminology, that they deconstruct their false ego, but they don't reconstruct their real ego?
Yeah, but it's actually, yeah, I could say that, but they just I would say it's not that they've deconstructed it intellectually. I would say is by the force of the circumstances, their mind became captivated and they forget about it. So in practicality, you could say that the situation deconstructed it, but it didn't actually create a new identity. And so naturally, as soon as the experience wanes, the old identity is reconstructed. You know, it's just, in other words, you just momentarily forget about it.
It's a sparkle.
Yeah, just something like that. It's just like sometimes, yeah, as a friend, you haven't seen for so long, for that moment you forget everything. You forget you're in a place with tons of people, and you do something, you go over and this and that. And for the moment it's there, and then after a few moments, when the experience starts to die down, and you become aware of everyone around, all of them, you know, sort of form again. And you know, so they would probably take that moment to be transcendental. You know? And probably they have a culture where certain things are done so that experience is cultivated in that situation. You know? So if it's in another situation, then they might not even, they themselves might not define that as transcendental. They may say that's emotional. And only in this situation, then it would be transcendental. Who knows what their contexts are.
Is it linked to identity? By the moment of transcendental?
Yeah, because that's the final thing, is you identify, I'm the controller and enjoyer. You know, so that means at that point you're not really identifying as controller and enjoyer. You know, you just kind of let go. So you actually come to it means you become absorbed in the platform of aparoksha. Just the emotion that's happening at the time, you fully just give yourself to it. You don't observe it. Because if you observe it, you don't experience it. So they just surrender to that and absorb themselves. And because it continues, then it creates an intensity. Right? Because generally the aparoksha, because of the false identity, we tend to always be pulling ourselves back from the experience. Right? Because if we just experience a full emotion, we may feel embarrassed or do something we wish we hadn't. You know, like that. You know, it might be not sophisticated enough.
You would regret that.
Yes, you might regret it afterwards. You know. Like that.
Yes, the last question would not be able to talk to you.
Yeah, yeah, you got 3 minutes.
He says in the Buddhist very expert from India, that the Jagannath Puri, they used, before, I mean, in the Buddhist period, they used to worship Buddha, his teachings, and his association. And later, they were identified with Jagannath Baladeva Subhadra in the Jagannath Puri temple. So, how should we interpret that?
Buddha means his teachings, say again?
It says Buddha, his teachings, and his association. Later it became Jagannath Baladeva Subhadra.
Buddha, his teachings, and his association. Okay, so Buddha would probably be Krishna. His associates would be Baladev. His teachings would be Subhadra. Because she's Yoga Maya, so that's chit potency, so that's knowledge. And Balaram is then creates the situation. You know what I'm saying? The environment. Like that. So that would be your associates and everything like that. And then Buddha is Krishna.
Later again means only from the Western point of view, there's this chronology that the Jagannath Baladeva were always there, but
just
the Buddhists who had their own interpretation after that, there's another interpretation which is rather the original.
Mm-hmm.
Is it the way we should?
Yeah, no, they're always there. Because that's a pastime of Krishna.
And where was Buddha's tooth? Because we said that in the temple there was Buddha's tooth in the Jagannath temple, which was taken then to Sri Lanka when they were expelled.
From the Buddhist
tooth.
Oh, so the Buddhist took over the Jagannath.
He took the tooth from the temple
of Buddha.
Of Buddha to Sri Lanka.
Who took it?
The Buddhist.
Oh, so the Buddhist at one time took over Jagannath Puri.
Yeah, I mean that's
could be, because there's a lot of gap in between. Mm. You know, that can also explain why the tantra worship and all that. Because Buddhists are tantra. Some say Shankaracharya established the worship there.
Worship of
Jagannath. Whatever, it's got a wire position, so it doesn't matter. Yeah, because they also do, they worship Shiva, Parvati, and Time.
Buddhist?
They have different names for them, but that's the trinity that they worship. What exactly, I don't know. But I don't know enough about it. But that's the deities. If you see Tibetan Buddhists and stuff like that, that's they have the deities. They have Shiva, Parvati, and Time.
What form the time?
It's personified. No, it's a person. Person. Yeah, I never got into that, I don't know.
Okay.
At the moment. Until next year.
Thank you very much.